Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's just almost 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News on your FM dial at 104.3 in Juno. And we have a lineup of guests for Juno Afternoon today that should be very interesting. Emily Wall is here. She's doing a poetry reading at the UAS bookstore as part of the Friday Art Walk, and so we're going to maybe coax a little out of her, a little reading out of her as a warm-up for that. Joy Lyon will drop in to tell us about FASD Awareness Day. Zuel Bailey will be here. He's being interviewed right now on KRNN, and we'll have him over here at KTOO at 3:30 to talk about his concerts coming up Saturday night. And the Juno Charity Cafe, Megan Cruno is attempting to raise money to open a cafe that will fund nonprofit organizations in town. Weather looks like rain through the weekend, so we have that to look forward to as well.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Native American delegates at the Democratic National Convention say President Obama's speech last evening was inspiring and that they plan to spread his message when they return home. Matt Laszlo reports from Charlotte.
President Obama has struggled to excite voters like he did in 2008. But Native American delegates say his Thursday evening speech was electric. Just listen to them react. Delegates say the president's speech caps off a week that challenged Republican distortions and falsehoods. As for the takeaway, Arizona delegate Lena Fowler of the Navajo Nation says she's energized.
Goodness, this is so energizing, inspiration, inspiring, and just the excitement and the thickness of the excitement in this place is amazing. It's like just a big party.
Fowler says there's still work to do in Indian country, but she says she trusts the president to continue to make progress if he gets reelected.
Indian country is really, in a lot of ways, federal laws and just are really tangled up. And he's got to untangle them in order for him to help Indian country. But he's been able to accomplish a lot.
Now the convention is over, but Native American delegates like Fowler say they hope to take the message home and spur more voter turnout in Indian country this November than ever before. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Charlotte.
Earlier this week, other Native voices were heard at the convention. On Wednesday, Denise Juno stood before the crowd, sharing that she was proud to be there, not only as an educator, but as a member of the Mandan and Hidatsa tribes, and as the first Native American woman to win a statewide election in U.S. history. Native American writers are gathered in Milwaukee for a conference that looks at current themes in Native literature and how things have changed over 20 years. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
Michael Wilson is an associate professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and author of a book on Native resistance literature. Wilson, a member of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, says resistance writing challenges the idea that Native people are disappearing.
And instead argues that Native people are surviving, thriving at times. It offers a different, alternative narrative to where Indian people are going rather than the predominant narrative of the vanishing race.
Wilson says resistance literature is one of the themes that set Native writers apart from any mainstream authors. Native American literature professor Kim Blazer says many Native writers also talk about preserving the planet, and their writing is grounded with a sense of place. Blazer is a member of the White Earth Band of Chippewa and co-organizer of the Returning the Gift Native Writers Conference taking place in Milwaukee. Blazer says compared to the group's first event 20 years ago, much more is being written and published.
Before, if I was to teach a Native literature class, it wasn't that difficult to select my texts. But now, I did an essay on poetry a couple years ago, and there were over 100 Native poets just in the United States publishing, and now I know that number's swelled since then as well.
Blazer also says the Internet helps more writers get out their message. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
During this week in 2011, imprisoned Anishinaabe Lakota activist Leonard Peltier was awarded the Mario Benedetti Foundation's International Human Rights Prize. The foundation supports human rights causes and cultural preservation. Peltier, who is serving two consecutive life terms for his involvement in the shooting of two FBI agents during the 1970s Wounded Knee conflict, turned 68 on September 12th. This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's almost 6 minutes after three. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, and my first guest is an author nonpareil, a poet nonpareil, actually, I guess we'd have to say. Emily Wall is here with us from the University of Alaska's Creative Writing Program. Hi. Oh, I don't have your mic on. You have to say all that again. There.
Hi, Pat. Hey. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad. So you're going to do a reading as part of First Friday, I think, at the bookstore out on campus.
Yep, out at the UAS bookstore tonight at 5 o'clock. Sarah Hagen asked me to read some poems from my new book, and I'll be signing copies, and I think she's providing snacks and goodies.
I'm thinking, we were talking about this beforehand, I'm thinking the UAS bookstore has not been part of the First Friday Art Walk deal before, so you may be the premier event here.
How exciting, I'm totally honored.
Debut.
Sarah's amazing, she's done great stuff with that bookstore.
She has.
She's
also doing some yoga instruction in town and a couple of other things. She's into quite a number of activities. I ran into her on the campus the other day.
Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah. And I love just hanging out in that store. I mean, she's got great stuff and lots of great fiction, poetry, nonfiction. It's just really fun.
Yeah. So when you do a reading like this, who do you hope will show up?
Wow, that's a good question. I hope everybody will show up.
Yeah, but I mean, do you want your mother there?
No, maybe not my mother. You know, it's actually, I find it harder to read to people I know. Last year I gave a reading in Chicago at a huge national conference, and that's actually in some ways easier for me than a reading like this, because if I'm reading to my colleagues and friends and stuff, you know, it's a little more pressure. But I hope that anybody that wants to come will be there. I mean, I hope we have a good crowd, and I really hope people will ask questions or want to talk about poetry a little bit. I find that part really fun.
You've written poetry. You have a couple of books out. One of them is called Living Aboard. Is it Live Aboard? Live Aboard.
Live Aboard,
and this book came out of your experience living aboard a boat down in Vancouver. Is it easier to write based on that kind of unusual setting experience? Or can you just write about the world?
That's a good question. I find it easiest to write about the things that I'm doing. You know, my poetry is all based on things that I experience or things that I know. It's sort of true stories, basically. This book maybe was a little easier to frame as a book because it was this particular experience. We lived for 4 years on the boat down in Vancouver. We cruised for 4 summers. We sailed over 2,000 miles. And so it was kind of this set experience, and that helped me frame it as a book. My first book was a little bit harder with that because I wrote it over a period of about my first 7 or 8 years of living in Juneau, and so it was a little tougher to find motifs and themes and shape it into what felt like a cohesive book.
Hmm.
And this was a little easier for that because it was this singular experience.
So could you give us the central piece of the book? You brought it with you.
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you mean by the central piece,
well,
though?
Well, I mean, you know, if it has structure and if it was about the experience, is the heart of it somewhere in there?
It has really 4 main motifs running through it.
Okay.
You know, it has a bunch of different things. One is living aboard on the dock and getting to know the live aboard community, which was a really fascinating, intimate, crazy community. One of the motifs is really kind of living in the city. You know, we moved from Juneau to Vancouver, B.C., and it's a fabulous city, but it was crazy. You know, for us. One of those is kind of exploring issues of luck and faith and belief systems. I think people who live aboard, I don't know if I can speak for everybody, but a lot of people who live and work on the water have a lot of superstitions and belief systems and that kind of thing. So it deals a lot with faith issues. And then last one is just really looking at the natural world, your relationship to the natural world when you're living on the water like that.
So choose one of the motifs for us and give us a sample.
Okay, I'll read you a poem called Watching for Angels. Watching for angels. We see them on wingtips, flashing as the plane rises. We see them in closets at night, luminous as shirts draped in white rows. We even see them on the freeway, some shadow of light we thought we saw after a car swerved the other way. So maybe they've been here all along. Maybe as we walk out our doors this morning and pick up the newspapers, we look up and there they are, that solid, fresh stand of hemlock, needles fine as any magical thread woven with the first mist of morning. Maybe we breathe in their sharp scent of soil and rain, feel their presence as we walk back inside, their green limbs and silvery sap growing older and stronger in the light, and we feel safe as we ever will in this world.
My.
An angel poem.
Yeah, and a wonderful one, too.
Thank you.
I love the idea, the place where it shifts from the tree to the angel, to the tree to the angel. It's really that wonderful little vibration.
Thank you.
The way you did that. Well, when you were writing aboard the boat, how to say this, versus land,
mm-hmm.
Is there a difference? We talked a minute ago about sleeping on the sea and like that, feeling the boat mm-hmm. rock and knowing the salmon are swimming underneath you. Does the world feel different when you live on a boat versus when you live on the land?
It does to me in many ways, actually. One of my favorite things was sleeping aboard and, feeling the motion of that boat. It felt very womb-like to me, and I also love the idea of the salmon swimming under me when I'm sleeping, and birds being all the way around us all night long. And certainly that was part of the writing, too. I had just this little corner of the boat in my laptop where I would sit on deck sometimes and write, and it was just this extreme intimacy with the natural world that I've never found anywhere else. Even living in Juneau, even being outside as much as I can, it's not the same, I think, as being right there on the boat.
I think we crowd ourselves up with so many things when we have houses. Mm-hmm. But a boat has a natural limit. It's if you try to do something just beyond the edge of the boat, you're going to get wet.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
it does. And it makes you pick your possessions, which I found very interesting. I found that when I really thought about it, I used about one drawer in my kitchen, and that's when I moved onto the boat. I'm like, yeah, I need this spatula, and that's about it, mm-hmm. And same with my books. I could only take like 100 books instead of 1,000. So it does make you pare way down and focus in a way that being in a huge house does not.
Did you teach down there?
I did. I taught at the University of British Columbia full time, and I also taught for UAS doing distance classes. I did mm-hmm. both.
But now you're teaching at UAS.
I am, yep. I'm full-time out there now teaching creative writing and composition.
Are you doing distance as well as in front of the students?
I am, yeah. I really love that. It allows me to teach people all over the state, and particularly people that maybe are from small communities, can't come to Juneau, stay-home moms, people working at the mine. It gives me a great diversity of students to be able to do that.
Is there an element of... I understand there's an element of difference between the two. Is there anything that the distance student doesn't get because they're not in physical contact with you? Well, they're not touching you, but...
I don't think I would say there's nothing they don't get. I think the experience is very different. For example, in class, when you're having a conversation, it's very quick back and forth. And there's that kind of spontaneity that doesn't happen in an online discussion. But on the other hand, in class, there's always a certain number of students that don't speak. They're shy. They can't quickly jump in. I'm happy if I get 75% of my class talking. Online, I get 100% every time.
Ooh.
I hear every voice. And to me, that creates this great richness of diversity in the discussion that sometimes doesn't happen on campus. So it's just a very different experience. But I think they're both very valuable for students.
Have you ever taught a class where you're mixed? Where you're online at the same time that you're with live students?
Once. that was frustrating. I think anyone who's ever been in a teleconference meeting can pick up on the problems of that, because the people on the phone don't pick up on what's happening in the room, and so inevitably they get sidelined. I find that it really doesn't work for me very well, because they become sort of minor citizens in the class, and I don't want that to happen, so I prefer one or the other.
Yeah, that was my experience trying to do the thing at the same time. It's a mess. So,
yeah.
Well, tonight you're going to read from this book and mm-hmm. your other work as well? Or?
I'll probably mostly just read from this book tonight. I've given a number of readings from that book, so and I think my publisher would appreciate me plugging this one a little bit right now.
Okay. I noticed when I was kind of getting set for the interview, you have a wonderful website out there that has even a couple of your poems on it. So we can get I think there's about four out of each book that sort of gives a flavor and like that. Let's see. I can't remember if I picked it up. But basically, it's Emily Wall Poetry.
It's www.emily-wall.com.
Yeah.
And it does have and ways to contact me on there and connect to my – I have a blog and that kind of thing. So definitely check it out.
So your reading starts tonight at?
5 o'clock.
5 o'clock, and it's at the UAS bookstore with snacks, pieces from Live Aboard, Emily Wall reading her poetry. Come on out and listen to it.
Thanks, Pat.
Replacing the gold. I wait in the silence of darkening skies, searching the stars for stories never told.
Music by Paula Joy Welter from an album called Morning Light. It's 19 minutes after 3 o'clock almost, and my next guest is here to tell us about a very important event that's going on all around Juneau this week, I think. This is the day of which we, part of National Recovery Week, where we attempted to bring everybody's attention to fetal alcohol syndrome. So, Joy Lyon is here. Joy, tell us what's going on.
Yes, thanks, Pat, for having me. And this is a great opportunity for everyone to think about this issue that's really important, especially in our state in Alaska. So, FASD Awareness Day is this Sunday, and that represents the ninth day of the ninth month, signifying that you should really be conscious of not consuming any alcohol during the 9 months of pregnancy. So FASD is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So there are many different effects that are all negative for children or infants or that have been exposed to alcohol during pregnancy.
How do we? What tells us the tie between alcohol and these effects? Where does the research come from?
Well, that is one of the points that a lot of people don't know, is that alcohol can affect the fetus at any point, even before the woman knows she's pregnant. So if you're having a drink, you know, before you have the drink, you should think to yourself, is there a possibility that I might be pregnant? Because I think that is where people, you know, often just don't think about it. And they might have been out having a great time and, you know, on the weekend, and they didn't even realize that they were pregnant at the time. So that's the big aha moment for a lot of people, I think, is to, even if you have the potential to be pregnant, then you shouldn't be drinking.
So how widespread is this problem in Alaska?
Well, 1 in 25 women in Alaska report having drank alcohol while they were pregnant. And that is really a shock to me to read that, because no amount of alcohol during pregnancy is safe. There are different effects, you know, at each stage of pregnancy. Not all of them, you know, result in the facial features or things like that. But at every stage of pregnancy, that it affects the brain. And it's really, really toxic to the infant developing brain.
And a lot of the effects of this are behavioral as well.
That's right. And that's, you know, when you think to yourself as a potential parent, do I want to have a child that's going to have a really tough time their whole life? And, you know, and you have to weigh that against that that drink. And that's why we really are advocating for all partners. So it's not just a women's issue. It's all partners. So if you have any involvement in that potential pregnancy, then you are the partner. And so thinking about ways that you can support your partner in not drinking. So thinking about, well, you know, what, let's have the non-alcoholic drink, or let's have that sparkling cider out tonight, you know. So really, there's such a big role to play for men in this issue.
So in along that line, you've created a circumstance here where that's pretty easy to do for the rest of today. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. This is the restaurants around town are offering on Sunday to celebrate with women in their being abstinent from alcohol during pregnancy. There are restaurants all over town offering free non-alcoholic drinks for women that are pregnant. So we have lots of thank yous: the Bullwinkles and the Hangar, Rockwell's, Siong Sushi Bar, Paradise Cafe, Island Pub, TK McGuire's, Zephyr's, Basro, Capital Cafe, Subway, Zen, and Bullwinkle's and McDonald's in the Valley, Southeast Waffle Company and the Canton House. Those are some of the many restaurants that are offering those free non-alcoholic drinks. So that's a really fun way to celebrate and get the message across. And so we really thank those restaurants for stepping up. And then you might see these posters around town that say, "Be extra tough, stay dry during pregnancy." And all of our partners' agencies, I'm from the Association for the Education of Young Children, and we work together with over 16 partner agencies around town that all coordinate efforts and work with the Alaska Partnerships for FASD Prevention. The Alaska FASD partnership that works across the state to work on this issue.
Joy, I think it's really important. This is not just for today, though. If a woman is pregnant, this is for the whole 9-month period of the
pregnancy.
The whole
9 months, and, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, that is tough. That's why the poster that we created said, "Be extra tough." Because it is tough, you know, to really make that decision every single day during pregnancy. You know, and that's so, so important for the rest of that child's life. You know, that adult human being, not just during the childhood, but as they grow into an adult, that's going to be with them. You know, it's your brain. There's so much going on. Those neurons and synapses and things are forming. So important, their whole infrastructure of your brain is being formed during pregnancy. So that's that time we really need to protect that developing brain.
This is really a critical program, and that it's supported by a number of agencies, but there are also individuals who are involved in this. If someone wanted to give some time and volunteer to help with this, how would they contact, whom would they contact?
Well, that's great. There's the Alaska FASD Partnership has an 800 number. That's 1-888-464-8920.
Okay, so most of the bars, restaurants around town are giving away free non-alcoholic drinks through tonight. And there's information at that 888 number if people want to volunteer or gather more information about this. And this is FASD Awareness Day, Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Awareness Day, part of Recovery Month.
That's right.
Joy, thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 7th of September, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet Edith Sitwell, born Scarborough, England, 1887. Her parents, Sir George and Lady Ida, baffled by their daughter. The mother was a great beauty, the daughter was not. She was rather tall and thin, with a curved spine and a hooked nose. Her parents forced her to wear an iron brace on her back, a contraption on her nose in an attempt to make her more attractive. She was a bright and curious little girl, but her father was opposed to formal education for women. He thought it made them less womanly, so he wouldn't let her go to school. And she left her family on bad terms, Edith Sitwell, who went ahead to make her own life as a modernist poet and a public personality in Britain. She wrote many books of poems and put herself forward as a colorful personality. She wore enormous rings, turbans, old-fashioned gowns. She was a friend of Eliot and Graham Greene. She championed Dylan Thomas's poetry. She was a friend of Marilyn Monroe. And her best-known work was Facade, a series of poems set to music by Sir William Walton. The first London performance of Facade did not go so well. There was an old woman in the audience who waited outside afterwards, hoping to hit Sitwell with an umbrella. Noel Coward walked out on it. Virginia Woolf didn't much care for it. Edith Sitwell said, "I am an unpopular electric eel in a pool of catfish." It's the birthday of Joe Klein, born in Queens, 1946. Author of Primary Colors, the novel based on Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign. And it's the birthday of writer Margaret Landon, born in Summers, Wisconsin, 1903. When she was 23, she and her husband went off to be missionaries in Thailand. She ran a school there, she raised her three children, and while she was there, she came across a book by a woman named Anna Leon Owens, a Welsh governess, who had tutored the King of Siam's many wives and children back in the 1860s. Margaret Landon wrote a novel based on it called Anna and the King of Siam, which was a bestseller and became the basis for the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical The King and I. Here's a poem for today by Natasha Trethewey, Theories of Time and Space. You can get there from here, though there's no going home. Everywhere you go will be somewhere you've never been. Try this. Head south on Mississippi 49, one by one mile markers ticking off another minute of your life. Follow this to its natural conclusion. Dead end at the coast, the pier at Gulfport, where riggings of shrimp boats are loose stitches in a sky threatening rain. Cross over the man-made beach, 26 miles of sand dumped on the mangrove swamp, buried terrain of the past. Bring only what you must carry, tome of memory, its random blank pages. On the dock where you board the boat for Ship Island, someone will take your picture. The photograph, who you were, will be waiting when you return. Theories of Time and Space, a poem by Natasha Trethewey from Native Guard, published by Houghton Mifflin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Written by Betsy Allister, edited by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 3:30, and you're in tune with KTOO News. My next guest, if you haven't heard, is here to do a concert that is something of almost a physical feat. Zul Bailey is with me and is doing all six of Bach's cello concertos, all in one performance. And I understand you've added a second performance.
Yes,
in response
to first of all, it's very rare to do the complete Bach cello suites in one concert. And we made it an event style concert, and obviously, what's unusual about this is that I have to be in Anchorage on Monday. Usually, I'm on the late flight out to play someplace the next day, and I guess fate had it that I actually had a day off that I was going to actually spend in Juneau anyway, mm-hmm. which is very interesting. So when this incredible concert this evening sold out so quickly, the first thing that Linda Rosenthal asked was, would I consider, even contemplate, would I be able to move my arms and legs the next day to do it again? Because people were clamoring to try to get in to hear this once-in-a-lifetime thing. So I agreed, and so on Sunday afternoon we'll do it again at 4 o'clock.
So we're on Saturday, September 8th, beginning at 7:30, and that concert is pretty well sold out, I think. That's at the Egan Library.
It is indeed sold out. I've been telling people... it's better if you cannot make Sunday, if it's indeed an impossibility, I would walk up on Saturday to see if anyone doesn't show, because definitely all the seats are sold. But I have walked in New York City when they said sold out many times, and I've stood in the back and these kinds of things where I found a seat when someone at the last minute couldn't make it. But it's definitely going to be the place to be, that's for sure.
And then Sunday the concert is at what time?
It's at 4 o'clock.
4 o'clock. So the special added concert is 4 o'clock, and is that also at the Egan Library?
Gosh, I believe it's at Trinity.
Oh, yeah, it's at Trinity. Okay, yeah. Good. Yeah. Okay, so now that we've done the commercial,
right.
Now I want to ask you the question that we talked about before I opened the microphones, and that's this. Speaking personally, I feel intimidated by the things that I read about classical music because I'm not a classical musician, and I'm wondering how I should approach your music. How do you expect me as a layperson, kind of?
Look, I am way past the point of, my life in music is very simplified. I love things or I don't. I either understand things or I don't. I want beauty. I want introspection. I want calm. I want spaces to think. I want to understand, but I don't want to overcomplicate things. This is just in my own life. If I'm not ready to understand something, then I don't force it. This is how I am with music. And one of the things that I try to explore with the audiences is that this is some of the most beautiful music ever written, period. So if I said nothing to you and just played this for the audience, they would feel a warmth, they would feel a sincerity and a purity, but they wouldn't know why. They would start to realize that the cello is a voice very similar to the human voice, the high and low registers. And right in the middle, it's as someone is speaking to them. So the performer is telling them a story, a very comfortable story. Now, what is that story, and why do we care? Well, the more you dig deep into the layers of classical music and or a particular piece or group of pieces, this is what, in many ways, makes it even more interesting and makes you want to come back and listen for again and again and again. Bach is considered by many as God of classical music. He was at the very beginning, 1685 was the year he was born. Everything he wrote, he inspired so many composers after him. In fact, I would say that 99% of composers kind of hold Bach as being their inspiration, whether it be their form of how he wrote or the voicing, the harmonies. Long story short, the Bach cello suites are, in my opinion, I don't know if I dimed this quote or saying, but I see them as the cellistic Bible, and for a couple of reasons. First of all, they are the beginning of the cello as an existing solo instrument. And secondly, as like the Bible, if one went to church, every verse could be interpreted many different ways based on whatever the minister or such is pastor is trying to relay. There is no manuscript of the Bach cello suites, which means there's nothing in Bach's handwriting. It's the closest thing we have is his second wife, Anna Magdalena, and she wrote down what people did during the day. So she didn't give us a lot of direction as well. So there was direction meaning dynamics, which is loud and soft. She didn't give us tempos, fast or slow. They're dances. They're preludes. Prelude is an entryway into a dance format. Each suite is built on six movements, and it's essentially a dance party with a different theme, which is the key signature. Blah, blah, blah. What the point is that I don't assume anyone knows anything. So the plan tomorrow night is to walk out as an unknown, where people don't know where this evening is going, and I'm going to play the first Bach suite, which in many ways, well, is probably one of the most famous pieces of music ever written. It's an every time you see a cello in a movie, from Master and Commander to the movie The Soloist to everything, you hear this Bach piece. After we walk through this piece without any description, I began talking and telling you stories. I tell you stories from everything from my cello, which was built when Bach was 8 years old. I will show why it's an interesting instrument, to why I'm sitting the way I am physically on stage, to why this music is important to me, to why Bach wrote it, for what they should be listening for. So I'll walk them through the next suite, sort of, verbally. So then now, they start applying intellect and reason and accessibility to the next layer of the onion. And then, they start applying what they know then into the third suite, and then the fourth suite. So we build together an awareness. So by the time we get to the sixth suite, they're masters of awareness and understanding. But more importantly, when you do all the suites 1 to 6, something happens chemically inside of you, and me too. It's something that I can't describe. I just tried to describe it recently as anybody who's an exerter of themselves knows that when you start jogging or exercising, the beginning is kind of hard. You're aware of your body, you're aware of your joints, you're aware of your mind and your breathing. But after about 3 miles, endorphins, I don't know, scenery, your thoughts, they all kind of jive, and you kind of are out of body. When we get to that place, which is about the third suite, there is something that happens in listening to this music that you can't imagine. It changes everything. So then you want to hear the first two again. So you want to go back, and then you have more. It opens up a whole... It's like you take the glasses off and you see color for the first time. You find places in your own life and imagination that you didn't really... haven't taken the time to explore in your own thoughts. It's unlocked through Bach's sounds. Similar to what they used to say is the Mozart effect, the Mozart would make you smarter. Bach makes you spiritually enriched in ways that I have found no other composer. It actually makes you more powerful. So, tomorrow night, my goal is to be very casual and walk everyone through this as I'm feeling it. I don't know what that means yet, because it's quite a journey. It's step by step. And by the end of the 2.5 hours, we're going to all walk out taking a deep breath going, I can't believe we were all witness to this. And that's how I want to feel. Then I have to go home, ice my arms, and do it again on Sunday, which I wasn't planning on.
And then get on a plane and fly up to Anchorage
I know.
And play again on Monday night. So, I'm not going to apologize for everyone's desire to have a crack at this, particularly after now. Having heard what you have to say, obviously you've thought this through. You started playing these things every day when you were 13 years old, was what I read in a newspaper interview. Is that true?
I've been playing them forever, and it's interesting that I started the cello when I was 4, and they started.
It's fine.
They started making me. I started asking the questions, quite frankly, when I lost a teacher, for lost meaning, didn't have a teacher anymore. When I had people guiding me, I didn't ask the right questions of myself as a person, as a musician, as a technician, these kinds of things. It's when I got out of Juilliard and I had no guide that the Bach started becoming my guide.
Hmm.
So, yes, I started them at a young age, but like in life, you know, it's almost kind of like maybe one would view their parents. You know, you have your parents, they're all over you as a kid, you don't listen to them, you try not to listen to them, you poo-poo all of it, and then you kind of get into your 20s and 30s, you kind of go, well, maybe they were right, or I now know why they did that. And you start kind of making your own decisions based on what you know. I'm a big believer that you have to make decisions properly. You have to know where you've been to know where you're going. So it just took going back and digging up all of the research and history of these pieces to understand what is the point of this? Well, there's a lot of points of it. That's what makes it great, and that's what makes it still applicable today. Above everything else, it's the most gorgeous music. But once people go in tomorrow night or Sunday, they will then be forever changed by Bach. And then I guarantee you, they'll go on iTunes and everywhere else to try to get more Bach in their life, and they'll start playing it in their house because why not? Why would someone not want to feel beautiful?
So, how does somebody, what you'd have to speculate, and the question is, how did Bach do this? In other words, if what you're saying is true, if this music is almost divinely...
Well, Bach's whole perspective, which is very one of the more interesting things I read about him, if you were to compare him and Handel, it's the whole idea of a greater being in their life. So when they write, are they writing as an offering to the greater being, or are they offering as are they writing as an equal to the greater? Like they think they're all that. Handel, no disrespect, wrote because he knew he was going to heaven. He knew that it was at that point in history, everyone saw it as heaven and hell, and people obviously didn't want to go to hell. So they Handel was like, it's just, you know, it's me and God, and all the music I write is in the glory of God, meaning we're celebrating. Yay. It's going to be great. It is great. Yeah. Bach wrote not knowing if he was going to heaven. Maybe he was going to hell. I don't know. He didn't. His music had an aspect of it that was scared, frail. There's fragility to it. Even though it was powerful, there was a humbleness and mortality that strikes a chord in all of us. So he wasn't writing necessarily to prove anything. He was writing to say to the greater being, please consider me. Please, you know, he was bowing his head down, looking up versus, you know, high-fiving. And so I think that comes through in his music. Now, of course, the output of Bach's work was his job. You know, he had two church jobs. He was the organist. He was actually more known as a church technician, organ technician, than he was as even a composer or this or that. And he had such an output of music because one didn't go to the store and buy music. They created it. And that many of his works were found in delis with meat wrapped in them. And I say that because it was spare paper.
Yeah.
They didn't realize that this was a great piece of music. They just saw a piece of paper, and there's so much Bach laying around. Let's just use that. So, you know, it's you know, you're never necessarily a king in your own lifetime, but Bach certainly wasn't what we see of him now, then, during that time. And these cello suites came about... actually, in the discovery in the late 1800s through Pablo Casals, realizing that they were genius masterworks, not technical exercises, etudes, warm-up things, which they were deemed for a long time. In fact, you can go even back further, and Bach really wasn't a big deal until Mendelssohn put him on the map. Mendelssohn was a very rich man who had a lot of affluence, and he used his money to write books on Bach, as well as to have his works premiered and played more. So that was 80, 90 years after Bach was gone. So I think I forgot the question, but I just went off on a rampage.
Your rampage was wonderful because where I was trying to get to here is how Bach could have done what you say that he did. The other question I have about the cello suites is Bach didn't play the cello.
But of all, that's a great question, but of all the composers, I think, in history, Bach is one of the only ones that I know that all instruments can play all of his pieces. Transcriptions are everywhere of Bach because his music is music. It's not necessarily only for that instrument. So the Bach cello suites are played from everything from trombone to guitar to viola to everything on piano. Certain suites, actually, you can see how they'd be played on the organ or on a keyboard or a harpsichord or these kinds of things. So I think that he was just experimenting with voicing. You know, is it possible to take a cello and make this work, or a violin, or certainly a keyboard was his medium. But he's probably the only example of that, because you can hear his music on any instrument, and you still hear his music, and you don't go, wait, that doesn't sound right, because it does sound right.
Well, I hadn't counted on this, but we have a wonderful opportunity here, and that is we have a little more time than I had expected. I have your CDs handy here, and I'm wondering if we could we do a movement, and in the fashion that you intend to do it tonight? Would you be comfortable doing it?
Sure. What would you like to do?
Your choice. Tell me which of the pieces you'd like. I'd like to play perhaps a movement.
Okay. Why don't you take the fourth prelude
of
the fourth suite?
Okay.
And the reason why it exactly is what we were talking about now. this piece is heinously difficult on the cello, because it actually sounds like it should be played on the piano or the organ. The fact is that we're talking about the prelude here. The bass tones would be the equivalent of Bach using his feet on the organ to play the bass tones down below on the manual on the ground, and the rest are right in position in E-flat major. And the hands don't have to move very much, but you get this spiral motion, circular motion of yum, ba 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 boom, ba boom. Ba-boom. So you can see him rocking at the keyboard, hitting those low tones. So as a musician, or as even subliminally, you start to hear that the foundational, the beats of the notes at the very bottom are what we're listening to while spiraling around all these other notes. Now, to take another observation, right in the middle of all this craziness is kind of a cadenza. Now, that's where Bach would have gone crazy on the organ during a church service, where all of a sudden, now I get to pull all the pipes open and go crazy for a little while. Then I come back to, it's kind of like in a pop song, where you have the bridge. So you've got all the familiar territory, and then all of a sudden the middle section, you're like, what's going on? And then you're back to the familiar territory at the beginning, and then it wraps up. And it's a terrifically underplayed suite, because it's in a horrible key of E-flat major, but mostly, as you're listening to it, listen to the fact that this could be so beautiful on the organ, and the cello that I'm playing it on is actually a church bass, truly, in this recording. So listen to the pluming bass tones of this spectacular cello made by Matteo Gofriller.
So the prelude to suite number 4 in E-flat major, and then we'll be back with more commentary. Thank you. So we're back. I could see it. I had the advantage of watching you as you did that
around.
Wonderful job of using your hands to kind of illustrate what you were talking about. So the organ comes through somehow. I can hear it because you cued me to hear it.
But it's also based on what you're comfortable. If you've ever seen an organist or seen someone play and move at the piano, and while they're playing, they're opening the stops. You would be able to see this if you just saw it. I mean, obviously, even when I'm playing it, you'll see the visual. This is what we don't have. This is what the glory of a live concert is. You'll see it, and I will point it out to everybody as we're going through it. I'll even get little demonstrations of what to listen for. But it's not that complicated, but it gets more complicated, kind of like wine, kind of like anything that's a fine, because you start to notice more things. And the more you notice more things, it opens up another whole thing. Oh, I didn't hear that before. Oh, I now know this. Ooh, that's interesting. Kinds of thought. And you can see he gets more and more complicated through the six suites, but in ways that are game changers, not just adding more notes or making something faster. He changes with harmony. Or one of the pieces that you said that you liked was the Prelude to the Sixth Suite. And that is very interesting because he just started writing for something that was an evolved cello. So he got to the point where he hit the wall with a cello, so he's like, well, let's just write for a cello piccolo, because I want different voices. So a cello piccolo has five strings. It has an E string on it.
Hmm.
So the cello itself had to evolve to keep up with Bach, as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah. In addition to giving a wonderful concert or two concerts here in Juneau, you've now become the director of the Sitka Music Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering where you'll take that festival.
Oh, well, first of all, I mean, Paul Rosenthal, too, he founded, conceived, he built, he developed, organized, created, inspired for 40 years to make the Sitka Summer Music Festival what it is. It's a festival in Sitka, Alaska in June. And in the 80s, he began a presence of this festival throughout the rest of Alaska. Anchorage, the Autumn Classics, as well as the Winter Classics in February. As you just alluded to, I'm his successor, which I was chosen about 4 years ago to do, so I've been in transition for this for quite a long time. And this was my first festival this past summer as the new artistic director. What is my evolution with this is to shoot for the stars. What does that mean? Well, we evolve daily based on how the world evolves and how music can bring great joy to others. What I love about this festival, it's become the premier classical music presenter in all of Alaska because we are bringing the music to the people. So not only do we present this great festival, the word festival is a party, celebration of music for both musicians and the audiences in Sitka, but then when the festival, everyone goes their separate ways, we tour. So we take these musicians and or these pieces, and we go to the villages, whether it be Nome, Ketchikan, Kenai, Anchorage, Juneau. And we are working in collaboration with the other great series and festivals, obviously Linda Rosenthal's Juneau Jazz and Classics. We are stronger together, and one of the goals that I'd like to do is to have all of the organizations work closely together to create quite a wonderful platform for the arts. We have a new executive director, Kayla Betcher, who, because we've moved our center from Anchorage to Sitka, so now we're completely based out of Sitka, but we have, that's also the advent of email and cell phones. We can be anywhere, mm-hmm. But the mothership is now based in Sitka. Run wonderfully by Kayla Betcher, and of course, we're everywhere. And so I'm here now in Alaska for 3 weeks, and I come back in about a couple of months, and I'm here for December, and then I'm here in February, and we're just we are carrying the torch, as I hope to do in what Paul showed as possible, Paul Rosenthal.
To what extent is this an extension of what you're doing in El Paso?
Very similar, but different. It's interesting that I'm trying to impact 800,000 people in the region of El Paso, Juarez, New Mexico, during January, and through their main series, and I'm trying to reach 800,000 people in all of Alaska. The same thing, El Paso is a sprawl. It's 37 miles long. And because it's split by a mountain range, we have to take music to the people as well. And, it's about creating consistency of the arts, so people don't just have a shock treatment every once in a while. They assume that they're going to get the arts consistently where they can grow with it and build from that. So being a man on a mission to bring beauty to others through music is a common thread that I bring to whatever I'm involved in.
And what a wonderful career you've created.
Thank you.
Or I guess created and had created around you.
Well, I always felt that that a person who is this obsessed has no choice. I really did. Someone told me one time, I was 11, that if I found what I truly loved to do and found a way to have a life doing it, I'd never work a day in my life. I wake up so happy to be trying to bring music to people and make an impression and bring joy to others through the music, that I don't feel like I've ever, none of this has worked to me, so it's, I feel like I have limitless energy to do it.
Amazing. Zuhl, the concert tomorrow night begins at...
It's at 7:30.
7:30, however, it's sold out.
At the Egan Library, I would say it again, stand in the back if you can't get tickets for Sunday even. But Sunday, we've added another show. It's at
4 o'clock.
4 o'clock.
Trinity,
yes,
right. And tickets are still available for that.
And that's very limited seating. I mean, there's only a little over 100 seats available for that one. So you had alluded to maybe doing a walk up for that. I wouldn't risk it. I wouldn't risk it at all, because I went to see the venue a little while ago, and there is truly limited seating.
Well, act fast, you know. We're going to close with the Prelude to the Sixth.
So, awesome. Yeah. Thank you.
I can be forgiven for talking over the top of Johann Sebastian Bach here, but I do have a couple of announcements I do need to make. Katie Bowser will be hosting Juno Afternoon on Monday, and she'll be starting out our Divas series. We'll be talking with Sandy Fortier and Giselle Stone. Steve Kochus will be here. He'll be talking about the planetarium presentation about black holes. Kathy Rudd will drop in to highlight Friday night's dinner and auction to benefit the Whale Project. And Jim Panier will be here. Panora will be here about Wednesday's e-waste event. So those things coming up on Juno Afternoon on Monday. New weather forecast just came across, still forecasting rain. Could go down to showers on Sunday. Showers are likely for Sunday night, and then Monday is mostly cloudy with scattered showers, so it should let up after the weekend. You're in tune with KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas, and we also broadcast in translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, we're on K276 AF at 103.1. And 101.7 in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269AO is the call sign. Gustavus listens on K201 AM, 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9 in an Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. You can hear KTOO on K210AS at 89.9.